This is an ABC podcast.
Live across Victoria.
On the ABC Listen app.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
The conversations that are important to you. In your town. Your suburb.
This is The Conversation Hour with Rochelle Hunt.
Have you been to Mardi Gras? Are you going this year? Short shorts, the feather boas, the fabulous drag queens, the dancing, and of course, the famous after party, where everyone from Dua Lipa, Kylie, and Cher have performed. But yesterday, just 2 weeks out from Mardi Gras, the after party has been cancelled. You add to that the loss of their major financial sponsor, some are saying that Mardi Gras is in trouble. So does Mardi Gras need the after party? Have you been to one of the after parties? And are you worried about the future of our biggest pride celebration? One 300 222 774. Have you been to the Mardi Gras after party? If you're heading there in 2 weeks, how important is the after party? And also coming up this hour, I'm not joking. Should cats be allowed in hotels? It's a real question.
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
No one to hear my prayer.
Well, the shoulders are shaking. There is some chair dancing happening. Yep, this is Cher. This is her version of ABBA's Gimme, 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 Man After Midnight. Just one of the international names that has performed at Mardi Gras after party. But yesterday it was announced that there will be no after party. Now, this is off the back of Mardi Gras losing one of its major financial sponsors. Some are saying that potentially Mardi Gras is in trouble. What do you think? Nick Henderson, committee member at the Australian Queer Archives. I can't see you, but I figure that you're dancing, my friend.
Oh, look, I am. Although I was there that year with Cher, and which was wonderful. But chair dancing was kind of the order of the day. She did a wonderful vocal, but, you know, look, I think the moves maybe not quite so much that year.
Not there like previously. Well, you know, I mean, she's
beautiful.
What, 80 something now?
Ridiculous. I mean, look, I couldn't get up there and do it myself.
Nick, after parties, there's after parties and there's after parties. People are always excited about getting a ticket, being allowed into an after party. One would think the after party of Mardi Gras is like the holy grail of after parties. 2 weeks out, it's been cancelled. Like, quite seriously, is that a concern?
Oh, well, look, you know, of course, you know, for so many people, having the after party and I guess the significance of, you know, whether or not it's the headline act or all coming together after having trooped up through the parade is, you know, it's such a wonderful moment for so many people. That said, obviously there's been changes and this isn't, perhaps unheralded. People knew that there was significant changes in recent years in terms of a declining footprint, declining ticket sales, more competition from alternative parties and much more. So it certainly hasn't come off the back of no kind of context.
Once you add all of those things together, though, will people start to think twice about going? Does it start to water down the event? I mean, this is probably, you know, one of our biggest moments of celebration, of queer pride celebration. What happens if all of these events start to fall away that are connected to Mardi Gras?
Well, look, you know, we have had this in the past, obviously, because where there was formerly Sleazeball, which was at the other end of the year and was there as a fundraiser for Mardi Gras. And so, you know, that that has dropped off. That dropped off in 2010. I think one of the other things, though, that has changed is that we've seen a significant increase in Mardi Gras' other parties and events, whether it's the ball, the sissy ball, we've got Black Cherry, we've got the Kaftana party, we've got other parties. And so this kind of proliferation of smaller Mardi Gras parties servicing and supporting different parts of the community. So I think it has been a broader shift in terms of organisation, even if that kind of headline moment that people think about in that 90s period of five venues and 20,000 people is perhaps not quite where we're at anymore.
I know the CEO, Jesse Matheson, has said it was around mounting costs of staging such a big event. And if you think about what you were just saying then, Nick Henderson, about all the little smaller events popping up, it's very similar to just the festival circuit in general, that people can't afford to stage these big events, that it's just getting too costly. Nick, stay with us because Kirsty's in Sunbury.
I volunteered as a dancer, as a parade marshal, and then progressed through to be a team leader and a section leader and doing that amazing section along Flinders Street as it comes up and is the elbow joint where Sher popped out of the Qantas jet.
Oh, my goodness.
So I'm a bit of a veteran. I was there for that. It was quite ridiculous and amazing at the same time to see her come out of that. It's always been a sense of pride and joy. It's always been a wonderful, wonderful celebration. In the 90s, the volunteers went to the party for free. It was part of what the payment was for us volunteering. And that was whether you volunteered at the parade or you were a dancer like I was in front of 8,000 odd sweaty gays and queers, all of us loving it, at the after party. And the dancers were amazing. So to lose that is really sad. But I think it started back in the late 90s or 2000s when Mardi Gras itself started making volunteers pay to go to parties instead of it being the thank you.
It's interesting that you say that. There's a text from Sarah and it says there was a time when you actually had to be a member to go to Mardi Gras to get party Correct. Tickets. You had to actually declare your queer bona fides in order to get a membership form. They were the days.
Yep.
Kirsty, are you worried about the future of Mardi Gras or does it just have to evolve? Dare I say, could Melbourne take Mardi Gras?
Well, I also happen to be involved in the Chill Out Festival, which happens here in Daylesford, which is also really great. So I volunteer there as well. I guess I'm a career queer volunteer. been loving it. Sorry, that was a bit terrible.
No, I love it.
But look, I do worry about it. Yeah, of course I do. It's a national pride day, really, and Sydney has always owned it and always loved it. I think there's been struggles over the years with Mardi Gras. I think it's change of management, whatever, it's investments. The gentleman before who was talking about sleazeball, yes, I used to dance and volunteer at that as well. That was always a fundraiser.
You get around, girl. I love it.
Oh, look, I was young then.
Oh, it sounds fabulous.
now I'm not so much. But look, I think it's very important that we keep it. I would love to keep it. It would be sad to lose it. Of course, we all want everything here in Melbourne. I am actually a New South Wales girl, born and bred.
I feel like, strangely, it belongs in Sydney, though. I never really thought I would say that, but it belongs in Sydney. Yeah,
it's a totally different party. It's a totally different scene. And I think losing corporate sponsorship, yes, is big, but also losing access to the parties that raise funds is difficult as well. And I think COVID kind of killed it.
Are you going this year, Kirsty?
World Pride. I have just had a hip replacement.
Oh,
so I
too much dancing.
Will not be able to. It's from all the dancing. In my
Are you okay?
Life. Yes, I'm okay. Thank you so much. I'm 16, 17 weeks post, but I'm not going to be able to make Mardi Gras and march and dance as well as I could have in past
years.
Oh,
but you'll be there in spirit. Kirsty, thank you so much for your dedication and your enthusiasm and for your love of dancing. And I feel like we've never needed that more. Nick Henderson, committee member for Australian Queer Archives. You've also curated incredible exhibitions that looks at the importance of queer party culture. And once upon a time, if you were same sex, if you identified as queer, you couldn't go out, you couldn't party, you couldn't celebrate. We have to remember everything that is just so important about Mardi Gras. I am quite surprised that big major sponsors haven't replaced the one that they lost. In terms of getting those sponsors, do you have any thoughts on, you know, why that void hasn't been filled?
Oh, look, I mean, often what happens in this situation is that we're talking very compressed timelines. So even though there might be long-term sponsors who might have more of a close affiliation to, for example, the parade itself or to Fair Day or to particular events, getting a new sponsor on for an event like the party, which is quite a different sort of ask, is quite tricky. And, you know, I think with a lot of these parties over time, you know, they do fulfill that amazing function for community to come together. And for a lot of people, I think, particularly at this point in time, when it does feel as though there's more conservative attacks happening, whether it's internationally or even locally. I mean, if you just look at the media response in mainstream media to this event and this news, it's incredibly vitriolic. And, you know, it's an opportunity for abuse. And I think it's quite confronting for a lot of people who don't see that quite so often these days. But, yeah, it's very much still out there.
And if Sydney ever needed something and, you know, a time to celebrate and to come together for reasons of pride and joy and love, it's never needed it more, Sydney, right now.
Absolutely. I mean, it's one of the things having, you know, we're still very much in the midst of Midsummer Festival here in Melbourne, an event which I should say has more participants in its parade and more events happening than Mardi Gras. So if we're talking biggest pride, I think, you know, look, there's still there's a debate there. But I think, you know, we're very much in that moment when, you know, even with the events happening with Bondi, and that was obviously around the time when they were traditionally released tickets and there was comments about that, having other parties and other opportunities to celebrate are really vital for communities.
Nick Henderson, always good to speak with you. A question without notice, should cats be allowed in hotels?
Ooh, look, you know, I can't say, look, maybe it's if it's a cafe, within the cafe, and I'm not sure about the hotel side. I think, you know, just the, yeah, I don't, I think
kitty
the
litter.
Opportunity, the situation to impact others who might be impacted by cats is perhaps a bit significant. If it's a standalone cat hotel.
A step too far. Nick Henderson, good to speak with you. Thank you. Committee member at the Australian Queer Archives. Are you going to Mardi Gras? Have you just heard that the after party is being cancelled? How important is it? You can keep those calls coming through. Coming up in about 15 minutes time, we are talking about whether or not cats should be allowed in hotels. I'm not joking. It's an actual question. Already texts coming in saying, dogs, by all means, cats, definitely no. Well, if you wanted to start a fight, then that's going to do it. But up next, if you can drink ice cream, is it ice cream? I've got all the big questions today.
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
So if you can drink ice cream, is it ice cream? It's a question I've never asked, but if you think about it, is it still ice cream if it's not icy? So Tyra Banks, a supermodel, you may have seen her. She's been on shows. She's been around the world, big international star. She launched a new dessert chain or shop in Sydney called Hot Ice Cream. And it's raised a lot of questions. Rightly so. Our very own Casey Briggs did a deep dive on whether or not ice cream can be hot. And if it is hot, is it no longer ice cream? And it turns out that now, legally, she isn't allowed to call it ice cream because under the Australian food standards, ice cream must be frozen and it must meet strict requirements for milk and fat solids. Now, you might have noticed your ice cream is no longer called ice cream. Go to the freezer, pull out your ice cream tub and see what it's called. Have a look. Warwick Long, I know that you are a man of investigation. You like the very big stories. It just so happens, my friend, that today you are at an ice cream factory.
Yes, I've put on my overcoat and my monocle on this hot day, Rochelle Hunt, to work very hard for you to a brand new ice cream factory. And a new ice cream factory in Victoria. It's having its big grand opening today. To answer some of these questions, the labelling of ice cream is actually a serious issue when it comes to Australia. Victoria, the home of Australia's dairy industry, 2/3 of the milk produced in this country comes from this state. The biggest area is the southwest, and so I'm in Colac. Hearn Street, Colac, where a new ice cream factory is opening today.
And it's new. It's kind of a redeveloped. You're at Buller, and this is, I think, one of Australia's oldest family dairy companies. It's been producing ice cream or sort of, you know, dairy-related products for about six generations since 1910. It's in the heart of Colac, which has been impacted by fires. Workers in the entire community has been impacted. It's a huge employer. And we'll get to what you're going to be discussing on the Country Hour and ice cream in just a moment. But so it's not just Tyra Banks whose label of hot ice cream has been under the microscope. Our own ice cream labelling has changed because it's not meeting the standards that we have set of what actually classifies ice cream.
This Tyra Banks story just highlights a bigger issue for mine, and that's in the frozen section of a supermarket right now. If you go down that section of the supermarket and you actually look at the labelling, not the beautiful pictures of ice cream that you'll see on the front of all the containers, look at what they're calling themselves, because under Australian law, you can only call yourself ice cream if you've got 10% milk solids. So if it's 10% of a 1 litre is actually milk going into that ice cream. And there's a certain weight standard as well, because ice cream you can bulk up with things like air as you're sort of whipping it up and making it into the product that it is. And so there's a restriction basically on how much product has to be in there to be air. But it's the milk solids that's the interesting bit, because it's expensive, right? Dairy isn't cheap.
And we talk about shrinkflation. I mean, there's ice creamflation, if that's
well, yeah, this is, I think it's skimpflation, they call this, where you have the same brand, but they change a product. So in ice cream, vegetable oils are often substituted in for the cream, and then they can't call that product ice cream anymore. And a major blue label one that you'll see in the supermarket shelves, some of the biggest names, Street St. Peter's, are big names in Australian ice cream, have been for generation. If you look at the back of their tubs, but also some of the biggest brands when it comes to ice cream, the individual ones, you know, the ones you get out of the packet with the chocolate and stuff on the outside, some of them now are no longer called ice cream.
They will be called confectionery or something.
Yes, or a frozen dairy dessert is another term. There's a few terms. There's, ice confectionery, frozen dairy dessert, frozen dairy confectionery. And also on the front, you'll notice they won't say ice cream in a lot of times. They will call themselves deliciously vanilla. And stop there.
There are freezers being opened all across Victoria right now, and people are grabbing their, let's go, 2 litre, maybe if anyone's getting 4 litres these days, and looking.
And this is even some of the fancy 1 litre. You know the real gourmet ones with the different little lids and so forth?
Yeah.
So one of the biggest brands in Australia in chocolate is Cadbury, and they recently changed theirs, recently in the last couple of years, changed some of their ice cream brands to frozen dairy confectionery as well, because it went below the threshold of ice cream. So, you know, this is not me taking a name in an individual brand. There is a lot of different brands, as I said, Street St. Peter's, others that have done similar things. This is a change that's happening. Coincidentally, I am at an ice cream factory that produces ice creams. This company does a lot in terms of trying to have ice cream on the front of their packaging, and they see it now as a point of difference. So many ice creams now have changed their brands and no longer called themselves ice cream, that it's funny that an Australian company sees a hole in the market and simply by staying calling itself ice cream.
Wow.
They think they have an advantage.
It's so funny that you say that, Woz, because, look, we're partial to some vanilla ice cream in our households. There's always a tub or two sometimes in the freezer. And we got a brand that we wouldn't normally get. And because we're used to our vanilla ice cream looking a bit yellowy, right, looking buttermilky. And we got a different brand and we opened it and it was Dunny Bowl white, right? Like iridescent white, and that even my ice cream loving daughter went, this looks weird. And the texture of it, everything about it was totally different. And now it's all starting to make sense. Hey, Woz, stay with us because Jerry's in Pakenham. G'day, Jerry.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
That's all right.
I'm Jerry from Pakenham. And my mum used to make ice cream back in the 1950s. You know, we didn't have a refrigerator. We had an ice chest. This was in Morwell. And came out runny, and it always embarrassed me. But my friends used to come around to get it because they loved it. But that's
so there was drinkable ice cream.
That's right. In fact, I like ice cream that way. I usually pop my ice cream in the microwave for a few seconds to soften it.
Oh, see, Jerry, there's two types of people in this world. Those that like soupy ice cream. Mish in Oakley is one of those. It says, as a child, I used to deliberately let my ice cream melt and then sip it off my spoon. I would call it ice cream soup. I reckon you're one of those, Jerry.
I'm definitely one of those. No. Okay, and what about pet rabbits in hotels? Look, I've got to go.
No. See you. Thank you. No, Jerry, no.
I'm tackling all the big questions today, Was. Cats in hotels and can ice cream be hot? These are legitimate questions. But where you are in Colac at the reopening of a really big dairy factory and ice cream factory, you're in Colac. This is an important part of that community, Was, isn't it? Not just for people who work there, but I think for a lot of the dairy suppliers and providers and farmers in the area.
Hugely so. And we'll examine this today. We've got a third and a fifth generation member of the family that owns Buller coming on today. This is their third factory in this town. There's one on Murray Street, Cooper Street, I think. It's got the Murray Street label on the front. That's why I get confused. In the middle of town. And then Hearn Street here, there's sort of two separate factories now that have been built right next to each other. Huge employer, takes a lot of milk from the area, still has to pay farmers for their milk. And we often have some really tough interviews with them during milk pricing season too, because that is a very competitive market. We're losing dairy farmers in Australia. But it's interesting that the company, and they have two factories in Melbourne too, they continue to invest in one regional town. And I'm looking forward to discovering more about that today, because you see a lot of diversification, and I wonder what the value is of being connected really to one small town.
Yeah, and not moving to a city centre, and what that means for generations. I mean, this is six generations where you are now, but it also means if there's job opportunities that people stay in the area.
Yeah, and somebody we're speaking to today started working in like accounts payable straight out of high school, went away, came back to town, ended up on the factory floor, has worked her way through so many different... I think she's in charge of quality control right now, which sounds like my kind of job.
Yeah,
Rochelle.
Man, quality control in an ice cream factory.
and it's just fascinating to see those links in a community that keep a small town together. And Colac, not many people would call Colac a small town except for people from Melbourne, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's still a regional centre. But it regional centres even need jobs like this that aren't government jobs, that are producing something and making wealth from the region. And it's interesting to see that this company's seen a way forward, even by continuing to call their products ice cream.
Well, people are going to their freezers, Was. I've got text after text. yeah, going, Rochelle, I just checked my ice cream. Phew! The ingredients listed, and it definitely says ice cream. I've got text after text. So, yeah.
If you're looking at the back on the ingredients list, usually it's the bold writing just above the ingredients list. It's still small, and it'll say frozen ice cream or frozen dairy dessert or frozen ice confectionery. That's the bit you're looking for.
The temperature of Melbourne and Victoria dropped, right, as freezers simultaneously just opened. Just finally, Was, it's really important for you to be there because Colac, there was relief centres. This is a community that was impacted by the fires. There's probably people who work at the factory that have been impacted by the fires as well.
Yeah, dairy farmers who supply this company, I know they've got properties in and around Jellybrand, which you will still hear in our news as fires continue to burn in Victoria, and efforts are continuing to be put in place by authorities to make sure sparks and things don't come back up. We're still waiting across a huge amount of Victoria for rain, significant rain, to really let a lot of people have a big breath. I did talk back on the country yesterday about looking at a review of the fire season. We had a CFA volunteer ring in and talk about that. But I did ask him, like, have you been able to relax at all through this period? And he's like, well, yesterday when it wasn't windy and it was finally cool, I finally felt myself, like, you know, just take a breath.
Shoulders drop.
And I think everyone's waiting for rain to take that big breath. But definitely, huge impact here. You drive into Colac, the signs still say, watch out for smoke around this area. Fires are continuing to burn. It's things like that that make it really real in regional communities and what they've been through this summer. And the, you know, ramifications of that will continue for some time. But it is very much a big part of the conversation here today.
Well, it's wonderful that you're there. It's a hard gig spending your day at an ice cream factory. Seriously. Well, did your daughters just go, come on?
I'm going to have to cool down after you talked about cats in hotels, Rochelle. So I think I might go make sure I can taste some ice cream to make sure the quality.
What's your flavour, okay. Was? Are you vanilla?
I'm a big vanilla man, and yep. I like adding things then too. Like, so if you went to my grandma's house, she would have like some chocolate or some nuts or sprinkles. You know, all those sorts of things. Yeah, sprinkles that you could put on the ice cream. So I think that's still me.
Classic.
I had that. Thanks to Nana for that little bit of advice.
I'm partial to a choc mint.
Oh, yeah, the green one?
Yeah, with a bit of choc chip in it.
I like a macadamia ice cream too.
Fancy.
I'm going really gourmet. Yeah.
All right, well, enjoy your ice cream factory tour, Warwick.
Warwick Long,
host of the Country Hour, is live today from Colac at Buller. So many texts coming in about whether or not cats should be allowed in hotels. This, dear Rochelle, cats in hotels, discuss. Don't you mean cats in hotels, disgust?
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is the Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
So we know now that pet owners, right, we treat our pets like family members. They sleep inside, they have their own bed and blankets. Some even have their own little sleep teddy. You eat with your pet, you walk with it. Dogs have prams now. It's one of my new favourite games. When I see a pram coming towards me, we play baby or dog. Quite often, it's a dog in the pram. So the idea of leaving your pet at home when you go on holidays, that's starting to become a bit of a thing of the past. We allow pets on planes now. We're seeing pet-friendly hotels. However, when we say pet, the assumption is dog. So should cats be allowed in hotels? This is not my question. This is coming from hotels around the world. It's coming from cat owners. They feel like they're being discriminated against. Dale's in Locksport. Dale, good morning.
Good morning to you.
Cats in hotels, yes?
Absolutely. I'm not only a cat lover, I prefer cats to most people I know. and I believe that life without a cat is not worth living. However, I've been thinking about this problem, and I have an indoor cat. She doesn't go out at all. And I could have two kitty litter trays, because she likes to have one for number one and one for number two. She's very fussy. Mm. So we could have a liner in that. And then when she's been to the toilet, we could just put that in the rubbish, fold it up and put it in the rubbish bin. However, as I was waiting to be talked to by you, she then threw up on the carpet.
Cat vomit is like next level vomit.
Well, she only has dry food and it's very hard to clean. So therefore, we'd have to have carpet cleaning products in the hotel room.
And they really convulse when they vomit, you know.
That noise. Oh, it's awful in the middle of the night. You think, oh, my God, that's under the bed. How am I going to get that out?
Right. So, Dale, you started as a yes, your cat spewed, and it's now a no.
No. It's definitely
still a yes.
But we can't have the carpet in the hotel room.
All right. What about kitty litter in the foyer?
Oh, no, it's got to be in the room. Pussy can't go into the foyer or the canteen or anywhere.
And there's kitty litter. Yeah. I know, gross.
Pussy's got to stay in her room. Oh,
All right. I just hate emptying the kitty litter. Oh, it's like the worst job. Absolutely. Dale, thank you. Go clean up your cat vomit.
I will. Thank you.
Cats in hotels, it is seriously being thought about. But if you think about where we allow dogs now, I mean, I really don't want to start the dog versus cats conversation, but that's what this is. So dogs are allowed in so many places. And now how we treat cats, how we look after cats, it's very different to decades ago. Now most cats are indoors or supposed to be indoors. Cats, you know, aren't those sort of wild beasts that would just roam the streets. Now they're indoors and they're treated differently. So should they be allowed in hotels? Douglas Hollis is the General Manager of Accommodation Australia, Victoria branch. Dougal, from vomit to kitty litter, should cats be allowed in hotels?
Hi, Rochelle. Thanks for the opportunity. Look, this is an area where hotels are showing their playful side and developing programs, with pet-related sort of acronyms. There's a Paw program at a hotel, Pets Are Welcome, the Porfic Travellers program at another
Paw
hotel.
Yeah, Paw Seco is one that I saw as well.
And the Pampered Pets Vacation is another program, just to name a few. So it's a real opportunity for hoteliers to show their playful side, but importantly, not only welcome dogs, but certainly cats as well.
So we have seen a huge upswing in short stays accommodation and where we stay change. The momentum for hotels is definitely coming back. We're seeing more being built. We're seeing them become more creative. I wonder whether trying to, and a lot of people stay in short stays because they can take their dogs or they can take their cats. They're more pet friendly than hotels. Is this about the industry trying to claw back, if you don't mind my pun, I didn't mean that, some of their patrons?
Rochelle, the market is responding to evolving guest needs. There's a absolute proliferation of lifestyle hotels across Victoria with, you know, different design and amenity and experiences that really lean into what travelling consumers are expecting now. And certainly as part of that, you know, how we accommodate pets is one of those things and a very important component. And I think the difference with hotels, of course, we're a full-service hotel environment. So you go and stay in an Airbnb, and this is not a beat-up of Airbnb, but you might just get an accommodation for your pet. But, of course, we have full-service hospitality environments where chefs have dog-friendly menus. And I was looking at a hotel's dog-friendly menu just before. There's steak tartare, and I know you were talking about ice cream before. Mm. Bacon ice cream on the menu as well.
I know, there's nothing like looking at the menu and then realising you're either reading from the dog menu or the seniors menu. I do that all the time. I'm just about to order. Hey, Dougal, stay with us. Dougal Hollis, the General Manager for Accommodation Australia Victoria, is with you. We're talking about whether or not cats should be allowed in hotels. Andrew Dixon is the Hotel Manager of W Melbourne. Andrew, are there cats in your hotel?
Yes, is the answer to the question. So W Melbourne, being someone very inclusive with our human guests, we are equally the same with our pets. So we accept cats and dogs at our hotel.
Wow. So where are they allowed and where are they not allowed? And are cats allowed in places, like is there some cat dog, like how do you keep the cats and dogs away from each other?
Yeah, we have a really clear message from arrival, exactly what locations you can take your pet throughout the area. It's mainly public space and guest rooms. We don't allow pets into our food and beverage operations, as you can imagine. And we've got designated floors throughout the hotel which cater specifically for our animals. There is a cleaning fee which applies, which takes care of some of the concerns from your last caller when it comes to carpet cleaning and curtains.
So how many cats would you get? Like how common is this?
Look, we have an 18 kilo weight restriction, so there's not too many cats reaching that level as opposed to the dogs. But we can often find we've got 25 a floor and we've got 50 floors allocated each day to our pets.
You can sometimes have 25 cats there.
We can, and certainly cat, well, not necessarily cats, both cats and dogs.
Wow. And how do others react? So there's lots of texts coming in, Andrew, saying, I don't like cats, I don't like dogs, you know, I get allergies, I don't want them at my hotel. Yeah. If I was to walk into your hotel, would I know that there are cats and dogs there?
No, you wouldn't. You may see a couple walking their pet out through the main doors of the hotel and going for a walk, but that's probably the only point that you're going to see them.
What about kitty litter?
Yep, that's all a part of our cleaning services to deal with.
Wow. You didn't sign up for that, did you?
Yes, we did.
Wow.
No, we love having them, and it's great to see that some of the domestic flights are now allowing for pets to travel as well.
So the people that are bringing dogs and cats, I'm presuming they're interstate or they're maybe having a staycation. Are there many international pets that you have stay with you?
I'm not aware of any international travellers staying with a pet. Only, I think, relocating from abroad where we have had someone come with their animal at that stage.
And do you have a cat and dog menu?
We do, yeah. And Dougal actually quoted our menu.
Oh, there you go. Do you have Paw Seco?
Not yet. Oh, we did hear
have that
it
one
and we're
for
looking
free.
Into it right now.
Andrew, thank you. It must make your day so interesting. Andrew Dixon, Hotel Manager of W Melbourne. Dougal, will we see more and more hotels just doing this so that we're no longer seeing it as a big deal?
Look, as I said before, hotels are definitely responding to changing and evolving market need. And I think what's important, Rochelle, is it's not just the city hotels. There are a number of large-scale regional properties right across Victoria. So for the road traveller, there are options in terms of pets and cat travel, with their human companions as well.
Fascinating. Dougal, thank you. Dougal Hollis, General Manager of Accommodation Australia in Victoria. Sue's in Ballarat. Hi, Sue.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Did you take your cat to a hotel?
We haven't taken them to a hotel as yet, but they've travelled pretty much all of Australia in our caravan. And you said you see dogs in prams. We have our cats in a pram. But I sort of feel, if dogs are allowed in hotels, why shouldn't cats be? And if you're a responsible pet owner, you've got everything organised for your cat.
Mm. That's what it comes down to, doesn't it? And do they enjoy travelling?
Oh, absolutely. One of our cats, if one of us goes out in the car and don't take her, she goes, just yowls at the door. And they absolutely love it. They obviously have, they've got an outside pop-up playpen thing, and they go on leads and harnesses, and it's because we can't leave them home for 2 or 3 months at a time, They come with us.
There's a few people saying similar things to that. Sue, another says our cat always travels with us. We take her litter box in a storage container so everything stays contained. I bring blankets to protect furniture. I have my own sheet. I have a doona for the bed. Everywhere I leave, the place is cleaner than when I arrived.
Yes, I agree. But if we haven't got our van now, we've just recently got rid of it. So if we want to go somewhere now and somewhere will take cats in a hotel, we will gladly go. Because, as I said, you can't always leave them home for any length of time, or we can't. Ours go in a cattery if we do go anywhere that we can't take them. And that gets very costly in itself.
Yeah. There's been a few people saying that it just costs too much to pop them in places. So you must travel a lot of the year, Sue, do you?
We did. We're retired, so we did travel a fair bit of the time. We can't do much at the moment because my husband's unwell. But, travel's been a big thing for us. And the cats came with us.
What are their names, Sue?
Maisie and Charlie, two little girls.
Maisie and Charlie. A little bit more creative than our cat, who we call Garfield.
Oh, it doesn't matter. All cats are beautiful.
I know. Noel, you should never give a 10-year-old, the privilege of naming the cat. That's what's going to happen. Sue, best of luck, and we wish your husband all the best as well. Bruce in Rutherglen says, dogs and cats in hotels and cafes, the world has gone mad. You said it, Bruce, not me.
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
So another hot day, second day in a row, and we've had a heap of really, really hot days. So you might already be thinking, I'm not going to cook tonight. I'm just going to order in. It's too hot to cook. But is it too hot to deliver? So if you think about the person that's delivering your food, we have weather cutoffs, so it's too hot to work for so many different industries. Construction workers, basketball stadiums, for example. My daughter's basketball was cancelled the other week because it was just too hot. But what about food delivery, gig workers? Should there be a cutoff for when you can't get your food delivered? So the health of gig workers, right, it's been under the spotlight around the world for some time now. And in America, new data has recently shown that a pizza delivery rider is more at risk of death than a construction worker or a police officer. So how much better are we doing here? And are our delivery drivers, are our gig workers just working in dangerous weather conditions? 1-300-222-774 if you're a delivery driver or if you've never really thought about that. David Bissell is a human geographer at Melbourne University. David, we think about heat and working conditions for so many different industries. However, it will be stinking hot outside and you will see someone on a bike, in a helmet, in protective clothing, riding an electric bike, delivering food to someone.
Hey, Rochelle, absolutely. We know that there are so many work-related risks that gig workers face. And yeah, many of those are all about extreme weather conditions. And especially when we consider that 70 to 80% of people delivering food are riding on bikes or e-bikes, these people are super exposed.
So tonight, many people may be thinking about ordering food. At what point should we not be, or should we be thinking about this? I mean, does there need to be some type of law around, I'm sorry, it's actually too hot now, you can't order food, like the apps don't work?
Yeah, I mean, it's really tricky because in theory, one of the benefits of gig work, of course, is that you can choose when to work. You know, flexibility is touted as a big benefit. But we know, as you were saying, that during intense weather, when it's really hot, but also when it's really wet or when it's really cold, the demand for deliveries increases. So people like you and I would rather stay at home. So what this means in practice is that if you're a gig worker, it's not really you doing the choosing, because the algorithm is trying its best to tempt you onto the road by offering you higher rewards, because the delivery app is desperately trying to fulfill the larger number of orders.
Gosh, that's a concern, isn't it? That it's actually seen as a good time. We know around the world, there have been multiple spotlights just thrown on heat exhaustion, on the health of gig workers, whether it be in America or in other places. Amazon workers and their delivery, that was under a spotlight for a little while. How do we fare here locally in terms of the rules and the laws and the protections that gig workers have?
Yeah, look, I mean, at the moment, it's seen as a problem that individual riders have to basically deal with on their own rather than the delivery companies. And there are, of course, lots and lots of problems that we face in Australia because of heat with delivery workers. So the problem of protective clothing to protect riders actually makes you hotter. In the research that we did a number of years ago, many gig workers on bikes commented on being really, really dehydrated. And the reason for that is that they didn't drink enough water because they'd need to find a toilet. And of course, that's really, really difficult. So exacerbating the problem of heat and also cognitive wooziness. We're just not as sharp in the heat, you know, and this can lead to people being not as proficient at what they do. So yeah, absolutely. The companies, gig worker companies, do, I think, have a bigger responsibility to intervene.
Yeah, I know. I'm just thinking, right, if you need to drink water when it's hot, we're told that, we know that. But if you can't drink water because there's nowhere for you to go to the loo, and then there's nowhere for you to get out of the heat, has there been any thought to kind of safe spaces? Like if you think about where truck drivers would rest, and we know that restrooms for truck drivers alone is an issue, that there's no clean bathrooms, so that's a whole other problem. But do we need to look at the concept of gig worker spaces, like a common room for gig workers?
Yeah, look, we did actually have one in Melbourne for a little while. It was trialed and really, really successfully too. But of course, these things in CBD locations cost a lot of money. And so the question of who funds that and how long that funding should be became a bit of a kind of messy thing. But absolutely, CBD worker hubs where there are toilets, adequate hydration. But there are a number of other things that companies could do too. So in addition to being given delivery bags when you start off, these delivery apps could also, these companies could give riders cooling packs for hot weather. And maybe even restaurants too. They could provide water.
That's a good idea.
Even allowing delivery riders to use toilets, like really little things, but things that can make a massive difference to the comfort of this work.
That's a really simple solution, isn't it? And even if it's a small sign that says delivery drivers welcome to use our bathroom or whatever it may be, because if they're used to being rejected and being told no. And without sounding like an ancient person, David, once upon a time, delivery drivers were in cars and were actually hired by the restaurant, by the pizza shop or whoever it may be. And they're no longer. When was the last time a delivery driver was in an actual car?
That's right. It's quite a long time ago. I mean, some riders, some delivery workers in the, especially in the outer suburbs, certainly do use cars still to get about. But yeah, we've seen that kind of trend towards e-bikes, especially, and of course that is leading to people just being more exposed to the elements.
So just on another topic, David Bissell is with you, Professor of Human Geography at Melbourne University. We saw last night, we've been discussing since it happened all sort of evening and today, the amount of commuters that were stuck either in the underground train station or on trains last night in really hot conditions as well. As someone that does the work that you do, how were you reading what was happening in terms of whether or not people could go to the bathroom? There was assistance dogs that needed to relieve themselves. The idea too of being trapped underground and how that may have made people feel. You must have had some fairly different reflections on what occurred over the last 24 hours.
Yeah, I mean, what happened yesterday was really, really unfortunate, really, really bad. And especially when we think about it in that wider context where since the pandemic over the past few years, organizations have been trying so hard to get people back into the office rather than working from home. So to endure the commute. And for office workers, working from home tends to increase on really hot days. So braving public transport can be a really uncomfortable experience and a really big compromise. And thinking about cities like Melbourne, still many trams don't have air conditioning.
Yeah.
I was on a non-air conditioned tram going to St Kilda last Tuesday, and the look of utter discomfort on most people's faces was really...
There's nothing worse than sitting on a tram and just feeling the sweat build up under your legs and knowing that when you get up, you're going, there's a pool of sweat and water behind you. And it's not just trams. There's a text here from Ash, David, that says, I'm a bus driver and in 45 degrees heat, the worst place to be in a bus is in the driver's seat because 90% of the air conditioning vents are towards the back of the bus. We're surrounded by untinted glass and the buses... driver sections have no windows. It becomes a heat chamber. We should have reduced services on those really hot days. So even when you look at the glass, tinted glass, but you would think that a bus driver who's maybe working, you know, 8-12 hours on that bus should be cool.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I would imagine that transport companies like bus companies are going to be taking this really seriously, particularly when we think about how intense weather of the heat waves that we've seen of late are only going to increase in years to come. So this isn't a challenge we can sort of think, oh, you know, we've just got to get through this summer and everything will be okay. Like, this is something that we've got to really do some long-term planning on.
And just finally, David, back to delivery drivers and gig workers. A lot of this responsibility comes back to us. You know, we're the ones that are making these purchases, that we are the ones that are wanting food, snacks, drinks, anytime, anywhere. So we need to not only put the responsibility onto the big companies and onto the cafes and restaurants to do the right thing, but for us to think about it as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And certainly the research that we did with consumers in Melbourne is that a lot of people are really, really conscious of that. You know, it's not like we're not imagining that there's a person behind the delivery, you know, underneath the helmet. And so even just the interaction that you have, you know, when you pick up your food, when they come to the door, the riders that we talk to say, like, it makes such a difference when people acknowledge them properly. And maybe that's also an opportunity where you can say, hey, you're doing all right tonight. Do you need some water? Yeah, exactly.
I know there was, I saw an image actually on Instagram somewhere where someone had left out a 12-pack of water for delivery drivers and it actually had a sign on it saying, if you're driving, if you're making deliveries right now and you're thirsty, please help yourself, which is sad to think about that we have to put it out, you know, like we do say, put out water for the birds in the hot weather, that we have to put out water for delivery drivers as well because their conditions that they work in are just not up to scratch. But then there's lots of different industries that are coming around and texting saying, you know, working in kitchens, in hospitality as well, if it's too hot for drivers, it's probably too hot in the kitchens, the front of house, and for all of those grills and whatnot as well. David Bissell, we've been talking about pets in hotels and dogs in hotels, but there's a growing movement for people wanting cats in hotels. How do you feel about that?
Look, anything that makes people feel happier on the road, more comfortable, is great with me. I worry for the allergy folk around. Mm. We've been having a big debate in our workplace about whether dogs and cats should be permitted in our office. And the big pushback has been people who suffer from allergies. So I think so long as that bit is cleared off, The more the merrier.
David, thank you. David Bissell, Professor of Human Geography at Melbourne University. So posties is another one, saying let's not forget about posties. They have to wear the helmets and they have no air conditioners either. So I guess it's about just thinking twice when you deliver your food or when you make an order to get your food delivered. This, I'm a delivery driver. I've been driving for 6 years as a primary and secondary income. I drove last week in the 49-degree heat in Wagga Wagga. I chose to because it provided extra money for me. I'm in a car that I can lock without turning it off and leaving the keys in it, so I create a safe space for myself. Being in a car, I can choose to drive in the heavy rain. This also provides that extra income. Toilets, however, are quite hard to find, especially overnight. A lot of the service stations and councils and McDonald's close their bathrooms overnight. That's creating a lot of knowledge of where to go is helpful, but it still provides challenges if there's nothing nearby. I could imagine that would just be awful. I know truck drivers talk about there's just no clean or open toilets to go to. And then you add the element to that if you're a woman and being able to find a clean toilet to get to. I love this. This is from Maureen in Mentone. Rochelle, snap. When my son was 12, he was allowed to name our cat and he too named that kitten Garfield. When Garfield passed, I gave the name to the new kitten and I called her Delilah. Oh, no, Garfield. My Garfield lived to be 17 years old, and that's because Garfield was a white chinchilla, didn't look like Garfield at all, and was hand-fed fresh fish. I was left to my own devices and put, you know, dim sims in the microwave. Garfield was given fresh fish. That's it for today. Thanks for listening. Take care, and we'll speak to you soon.